From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, it's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, our foreign policy contributor helps us examine the evolving situation in Ukraine. Later, what sleep researchers have learned by studying more than 1,000 Wisconsinites over 25 years.
You know, you've been told all of your lives through school and health classes, oh, you need to eat right, you need to get exercise. But sleep matters too, and that's the real accomplishment of this sleep cohort.
Plus, connecting kids with nature through journaling. And Wisconsin writer Nicholas Butler's affection for his Wisconsin roots is evident in his debut novel.
It wasn't like outright sentimentality, but it was a real longing for the place that I had come from and a deep desire to sort of show people how great it is, you know.
Lake Effect comes your way next after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. The Obama administration yesterday announced it's imposing sanctions on nearly a dozen Russian and Ukrainian officials it sees as responsible for the destabilizing of Ukraine and facilitating the weekend vote in Crimea in support of secession. Meanwhile, the international community is watching Russia's next step closely, as the situation in Ukraine since the ouster of its top leaders last month has presented a standoff reminiscent of the Cold War. Art Sear is the Clausen Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha and a regular Lake Effect contributor. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, Mitch. I really look forward to getting together with you and your colleagues on a monthly basis. I appreciate it very much.
These are perilous and tenuous times in Ukraine and particularly in the Crimean region of Ukraine. Let's talk first about the vote that took place over the weekend in which the Crimean region, at least the voters that came to the polls, overwhelmingly chose to secede from the rest of Ukraine. What do you see as the legitimacy of that vote?
I don't think it's legitimate at all. It brings to mind the good old happy open days of Soviet communism, and for that matter, contemporary North Korea, 97% plus voted in favor of joining the Russian Federation. There is very pro-Russian sentiment in Crimea, historically and currently, but there were no international observers, and given Putin and associates' autocratic approach and suspicion of democracy, I think we should be skeptical.
It was a pretty hastily arranged vote as well.
It was, and also as a protest, those who were against annexation to Russia, there was a rather vocal effort encouraging people to stay home. So it surely was not representative, even if you believe it was reasonably honest, which I don't, by the way.
At the point we're having this conversation, Russia has not actually come out and said that they are planning to annex the Crimean region of Ukraine or not. Is the vote a warning shot across the West's bow that to stop meddling in the region? What do you see as the end game here, or do you think annexation is likely to take place?
Yes, I think annexation will take place. I think, in effect, given the presence of unidentified but clearly Russian troops and very heavy weaponry on the scene, given all the moves that Moscow has made, they are, in effect, annexed. It is interesting, though, how even the most ruthless dictators in the 21st century and in the 20th century needed some kind of public imprimatur. It's not sufficient just to have a military takeover, a political or military coup or both. You need to have some kind of public vindication and verification of the justice of the takeover. That's a 20th century development. And it shows how important public representation is, without getting too academic or abstract about it, I hope. It shows how important the people are, because modern dictators feel they must have at least some indication that the people are for them. That's a change historically.
So far, the West's reaction to this has been in terms of sanctioning particular Russian officials who are part of President Putin's inner circle.
Yes.
How significant a sanction does that represent, and how is the West likely to react if annexation takes place?
I think it's a very smart move. identifies the principal culprits. They can't hide behind ideology or propaganda or closed doors. It identifies the principal culprits. They're very active people internationally today, especially in Russia, a country vitally dependent on foreign commerce and foreign investment. I think it was a very smart move by the United States and our allies. I assume this will be followed by further sanctions. I think our whole response to this crisis has been prudent, measured, and sensible. There's not a lot we can do. And given the nature of that part of the world, again, historically, we could very easily spark a general war.
Is there a domino effect that the international community really ought to be concerned about at this stage? Vice President Biden has been in the Baltic region speaking with the leaders of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, who say they're concerned about the potential ramifications about Russian aggression in that region. How concerned should the international community, especially countries that are right near Russia, be about the situation playing out in Ukraine?
I think that Russia – I'm sure they're concerned. By definition, geographically, they're in a position where they're always concerned about invasion, especially by Russia, past and present. I think Putin and associates are paying a sufficiently heavy price for this move that they're not likely to move elsewhere in the region. They have invaded Georgia, and then they withdrew in a somewhat similar situation toward the end of the Bush administration. President Bush, Vice President Cheney, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, quite unwisely, in my view, pressed for Ukraine and Georgia to join NATO in addition to association with the European Union. Thank God that did not happen.
And why would Georgia and Ukraine's joining of NATO have been such a poor move in your opinion?
Because according to Article 5 in the very durable NATO treaty, an attack against one is an attack against all. That article has been implemented, activated once after 9/11. The NATO alliance operated as one in defense and support of the United States. One of the interesting developments was quickly after 9/11, French aircraft, not our most congenial ally, French aircraft were in patrol over the skies of the U.S. and Canada, so the North American long-range aircraft were freed up for strikes in Afghanistan, where we knew the Taliban had been headquartered and bin Laden had been staying. It would be very easy if there were the spark of armed combat for a local conflict in Ukraine to escalate regionally and directly involve Russia and the United States. I think of all the unwise moves that we've made since the end of the Cold War, that pressing of the paranoid Russians right up against their border was one of the most injudicious and reckless.
Well, and we ought to make reference to the fact that that Georgia and Ukraine, that the state of democracy, it seems, has always been somewhat more tenuous than in places like Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania.
That's probably right. I'm not an expert on the region. I think that both borders and democracy are less firmly established in that part of the world. There is a history of very brutal Soviet occupation of the Baltic states. Other countries in the region, in particular Poland, in effect a close ally of our country historically and currently, the Czech Republic, Hungary, they have closer ties to the West and a stronger democratic tradition and relatively well-defined borders compared especially to the Balkans.
Well, let's shift gears for just a moment to the Malaysian jetliner, that the missing Malaysian jetliner that's really captured international attention. And maybe let's start there. There has been a domestic response within Malaysia, but an international response as well. Can you talk about why the reaction from the international community to this has been so fraught and complex?
Well, it's very easy, of course, especially when you're an academic, to criticize things from the sidelines. My strong impression is the Malaysian government, and specifically its leaders, by on the one hand having a lot of press conferences but not necessarily having confirmed information, and on the other hand being very insecure about going to the experts, which in this case is the Americans, and in particular the FBI, the NTSB, and other American intelligence and scientific agencies. They've not been anxious, I think, for reasons having to do with national insecurity of a psychological sort to work with us. I think it's turned into a media circus partly for that reason. Lots of press conferences, but no real coordination. I think this will be followed by a serious and no doubt helpful review of aircraft safety standards and procedures, including having real time as well as recorded video of what's going on in the cockpit, as American urban police, at least, regularly have, metropolitan police have going on now. That would be a step forward given the unpredictability of human behavior and also the very complex technical dimensions of aircraft flight. That's not a really good answer, but I think that trying to think about what might happen as a result of what's clearly a tragedy, ends up.
Well, one of the aspects of the story that strikes me the most is this idea that the transponder that shows aviation authorities where the plane is can just be shut off.
Yeah, maybe they should not be shut off. Maybe that capability shouldn't be there. Reinforced doors as a result of 9/11 was one step forward, but there are other things that could be done. But human life involves tragedy, and anything mechanical involves failure, and human beings fail. Eventually, we'll probably know what happened, but we may not know what happened. My father-in-law, who was born in the 1890s, was a very distinguished surgeon as well as general practitioner, M.D., and in medicine, his observations were often acute. He said things changed with World War II. After World War II, Americans would still defer to the doctor, but they wanted answers. I mean, you're the expert doctor, and I'm paying you, so I want an answer. Before the war, things happened. People died. They got sick. Acts of God. We don't know. Mysteries. But Americans especially, and increasingly the rest of the world, we want answers. And the media needs to have ratings to survive. So this is a natural-born story for endless speculation.
And finally, there is another international story that has largely gone unremarked upon in this country. But there has been in recent days an intelligence crisis in South Korea. What's happening there?
There has been a scandal that broke late last year. Intelligence agencies have been shown, the Korean Central Intelligence Agency, now renamed the National Security Agency, has been shown to have intervened to elect the more conservative candidate who was successful, President Park Geun-hye. She was elected by a substantial margin early last year. There's no evidence that she was directly involved in this, but well over a million tweets were sent out by intelligence agents and their associates endorsing presidential candidate Park and denouncing the opposition for ties to North Korea and treason. It seems very obvious and very crazy, but nonetheless, that's what they did. The most important observation is they're now being prosecuted for this. Historically, since the Korean War, the ties between our intelligence agencies and the South Korean intelligence service has been extremely close. One of the most impressive public servants I ever met is Don Gregg, who was ambassador to South Korea in the George Herbert Walker Bush administration. He was National Security Advisor to Vice President Bush and a career CIA professional dating back to the Korean War. It's important to emphasize the very positive dimensions of our intelligence service and our collaboration with the South Koreans. It's curious to me, perhaps showing a kind of parochialism that increasingly characterizes us, that we're not paying more attention to this extremely important story that bears on intelligence abuses in this country as well as South Korea.
Well, and one could certainly draw the parallel that the things that are at the heart of the situation in South Korea were not too dissimilar from the situation that was being investigated as part of the first John Doe investigation in the state of Wisconsin, but also things that the corporate world in this country has been criticized for as well.
Yes, and there is a largely legal industry in this country called public relations and advertising where some very big corporations make a lot of money doing that on the right side of the law, but it's very easy to go into the wrong side of the law. And certainly organized efforts by government officials to manipulate free elections, that's not only a red flag, but should be illegal. And in this country and in South Korea, it is.
Well, thanks so much.
Thank you, my friend.
Art Zier is Clausen Professor of Political Economy and World Business and Director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College. He's also a regular Like Effect contributor on foreign policy issues. We'll take a quick break and then learn about a Wisconsin effort a quarter century in the making to better understand sleep apnea. This is Like Effect from WUWM. Like Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. The disruptive condition known as sleep apnea affects the quality of life of an estimated 50 to 70 million Americans, at some level anyway. Knowledge of the disorder has come a long way in the last quarter century, thanks in large measure to a group of more than 1,000 Wisconsin volunteers known as the Wisconsin Sleep Cohort. Science writer Eric Ness looked into the work done with those research subjects in a recent article, and he joined us on the line last month to share more. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Mitch.
What was it that first brought this sleep cohort together at the University of Wisconsin?
Well, it's kind of a funny story. Back in, it actually happened in a parking lot outside the hospital. Terry Young, who was an epidemiologist, kind of getting frustrated into her career. She was looking at cancer clusters and the science was coming to a dead end. And all of a sudden she gets hailed in the parking lot by a cardiac specialist who's managed to pull together a grant to look at sleep apnea.
And at the time this was beginning, I gather sleep apnea itself was pretty mysterious.
I mean, it has been around for a long time. We've principally known to be a disease thought to afflict older men who snored. And the fact was there was just simply no way to treat it up until the mid-80s when we developed the CPAP machines, the continuous positive airway pressure machine, which is a mask that you wear that keeps pumping air into your system so that your trachea doesn't shut down.
Well, and so let's go back to this fateful meeting in the parking lot. What ostensibly was the reason that someone interested in cancer clusters and someone interested in cardiovascular issues got together over the idea of studying sleep apnea?
Well, now that we actually had a way to treat this, and a previous treatment was a tracheotomy, so a really radical kind of treatment. So basically, we didn't treat sleep apnea. But it had always been of interest to cardiologists, wondering what happens to the heart when you stop breathing at night. And so now that they had a way to treat it, they decided they needed to dig a little deeper into this mysterious disease. And the cardiologist, he's gonna follow the body side of things. But Terry Young was the medical detective, the epidemiologist. And her job was really to help design the study so that over the course of what is now almost 25 years, you could actually begin to draw some real conclusions. And what they did was they recruited 1,500 people, mostly employees in the state government system, the theory being that they're going to stick around and be reliable subjects. And every night, they'd bring a couple more people into the sleep lab. They would wire them up. And it took them 4 years, but eventually they got this baseline measurement on whether or not these people had sleep apnea, what their breathing and sleeping patterns were. And from that foundation, every 4 years, they bring these people back in, take a look again. Do they have sleep apnea? And maybe we should take a moment here to talk about what sleep apnea is.
I was going to go there. What do we know now? I mean, if it was known about, it's certainly understood a lot better today, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, a typically healthy adult will enter a light sleep, and then you'll fall deeper and deeper through slow wave sleep for about 90 to 120 minutes. Then you'll start your first REM cycle, that rapid eye movement. This will last about 10 minutes, and then finally you'll pop back out of that REM cycle and start over again. So this is what happens if you have a healthy sleep cycle, and you'll just go through these stages of sleep throughout the night. Now, while you are in REM sleep, you become partially paralyzed, and this happens because if you didn't, you'd act out your dreams. This paralysis can extend to the upper airway, which is what collapses during a sleep apnea event. The body tries to breathe harder and harder, but against that closed airway, it's kind of like sucking on a thick malt through a straw. So you're actually sucking the upper airway more and more closed. You know, the body gets alarmed and has to awaken you to get more air in there, but you never actually achieve full consciousness. So what happens is again and again and again and again, this cycle of sleep, suffocate, awake happens through the night, and you wake up in the morning and maybe you feel like you didn't have a great night's sleep, but you have no recollection of these events. So you could sleep, strangle, wake 500 times in the course of a night and never know that this is happening to you.
Well, and aside from the fact that it turns out that you didn't get a particularly good night's sleep, what are the ramifications for this? What's happening to your body by suffocating itself multiple times and sometimes many, many times over the course of a typical night?
We are still untangling all of that. But, you know, it's really clear now that all kinds of different things happen. It can affect your rates of obesity. It can affect your development of heart disease. There's this new phenomenon, not a new phenomenon, but we have a new name for it. It's called the metabolic syndrome. And it's this unholy alliance of obesity, diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure. The problem, you know, you've been told all of your life that these diseases are caused by how you eat and whether or not you get exercise. And that's true. But what we're beginning to realize is sleep actually plays a role in all of this as well. And that's really what the Wisconsin Sleep Cohort has accomplished in the last 20 years, was to begin to inject into the debate about public health, what are these things? Because you don't, you know, you've been told all of your lives through school and health classes, oh, you need to eat right, you need to get exercise. But sleep matters too. And that's the real accomplishment of the Sleep Cohort. And it's part of a much, I mean, sleep science has been absolutely exploding in the last 10 years, and I'm sure you've all seen the popular headlines about a wide variety of impacts and studies. But really, at the baseline, there's almost nothing in the sleep science world like this sleep cohort. You know, the fact that we've been studying 1,500 people over the course of a quarter of a century is really extraordinary.
Well, and interesting, you talked about metabolic syndrome. One of the points you write about is the chicken and the egg question, the conditions that often coexist mm-hmm. with sleep apnea, like hypertension and diabetes
and
other conditions. It's sometimes difficult to know which came first, but the sleep study has attempted to address that.
Right. For example, some of the risk factors for sleep apnea are smoking, drinking, being overweight. Well, these are also risk factors for high blood pressure. So how do you tease them out? You know, I don't understand all of the mathematical judo that these epidemiologists use to figure it out. But the bottom line, you know, they discovered, and this is one of the really important findings from the sleep cohort, is that if you had sleep apnea worth treating, and, you know, the threshold for treatment is 15 events per hour, 15 of these stoppages where you go through the sleep, suffocate, wake. So if you have sleep apnea worth treating, you were three times more likely to develop high blood pressure in the 4 to 8 year period that part of the study was conducted.
You also write that there's an economic impact to all of this, that this is not just necessarily, and that's obviously wrapped up in public health. This is not just about whether someone will develop hypertension or diabetes. There is definitely an economic issue to nipping this in the bud, if you will.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at the annual estimated cost of diabetes in this country, you know, $245 billion. Hypertension, $93 billion. Cancer, $124.6 billion. Now, we can't lay all of those costs on sleep apnea. Again, it's the chicken egg. It's all of these multifactorial things. But a reputable estimate from the Harvard Medical School puts the cost of sleep apnea between $65 and $165 billion. And it's the kind of thing that can really affect the bottom line. A recent study of 22,000 Union Pacific employees found that simply by increasing awareness and treatment of sleep apnea decreased the health care costs of that company by nearly $5 million in just over 3 years. So that's a big change when we're as concerned as we are about health care costs.
And so quite sensibly, this study has been playing out in Wisconsin, but the implications for the work and for researchers extend around the world.
Exactly. And there are some cool things that have happened. For example, Paul Pappard, who runs the study now, took over from Terry Young a few years ago. He traveled with his department head, Javier Nieto, for a scientific meeting in Barcelona a couple of years ago. While they were there, they met a Spanish colleague who was inducing sleep apnea in rats with melanoma and studying the tumor growth, and he was seeing these tumors grow faster when the rats had sleep apnea. Interesting, something that's probably not going to be in the literature for a few more years, chance meeting, but on the plane back home, Pappard and Nieto realized that they could really easily look for corroborating evidence in this cohort data that they'd been building for two decades. And so in just a short time, they found a very strong link between sleep apnea 10 to 20 years ago and cancer mortality at a later date. It's not the proverbial smoking gun. We need more data. We need more study. But the fact that this treasure trove of data was there meant that scientists could kind of dip back into it and confirm, or, you know, in some cases deny that wow, there's something interesting going on. We need to look closer.
This cohort came together almost 25 years ago. Is it likely to continue into the indefinite future?
Well, that's always the question these days. Unfortunately, the whole sequester issue is putting a real hit on federal research dollars. Right now, the sleep cohort did not get its funding in its first attempt, but that doesn't mean they're out of the picture at all. They're hopeful, and there's some really cool stuff that they're trying to look for right now. And this, again, gets back to having such an incredible trove of data. So what they're trying to look at now, or what they want to do, they've teased out all of these cardiovascular impacts, and what they'd like to do now is look at, most people are going to die of cardiovascular disease or cancer, but on your way, you're going to start dropping names. Scientists are wondering, could sleep apnea and sleep deficiency generally have a role in age-related decline of brain function? And so what the sleep cohort wants to do is to begin scanning the brains of the cohort. And that's an expensive proposition and one of these curious things where all of a sudden they've been funded by the heart and lung side of the federal research grant, and now they want to move over to the brain. And it's a different arm that does the funding. They have to do a little politicking to see if they can get past that. But it's a great question. As you age, you're more likely to be diagnosed with borderline sleep apnea, that 15 events per hour. And what the doctors wonder is, how aggressive should you be in treating it? How hard do you push someone who comes in with borderline symptoms? Doctors don't know what to tell those people.
And so obviously this is certainly a big question to be going after at a time when the general population of the country is getting older.
Exactly. And here's the thing. It could be a billion-dollar question. You know, with a burgeoning population in this age range, treatment for sleep apnea is annoying and costly. It might cost about $2,000 a year per patient. But if your brain manages to stay healthy longer, it could mean avoiding institutionalization later in life. The cost of caring for patients with advanced Alzheimer's disease and advanced dementia is enormous. That's on the cost side. But on the personal side, you know, what would you personally do to eke out an extra 5 years of a healthy brain?
It's a pretty compelling question and one we might just have to sleep on.
Yeah, and it's not important just for Wisconsin or North America. It's important for the whole world. There is no other set of data like this. We have no other aging group of people who've been followed for such a long period of time for this disease. So it is an extraordinary scientific opportunity, and I really hope they get the money.
Well, Eric Ness, thank you so much for helping explain it for us.
All right, great.
Eric Ness is a freelance science writer who lives in Madison. Our interview first aired last month. A new book from our outdoor adventure contributors is designed to keep kids engaged with the outdoors, even when they come back home. We'll learn about it when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. It's a phenomenon that gets a lot of attention, the idea that kids just don't play in nature the way they once did. That's a trend that Lake Effect's outdoor adventure contributors have been working to combat, both with our regular radio segments and through a new book, We Love Nature, a keepsake journal for families who love to explore the outdoors. Ken Keffer and Stacy Tornio are back with us in the studio to share more. Nice to see you both.
Thanks for having us.
Your last book was all about the many things to do in nature before you grow up. This kind of goes one step further. This is an interactive journal. So give us the philosophy behind what you're trying to accomplish with this book.
Well, first of all, I just think it's so cool. I love to tell people that I wrote a journal because it's like, it seems so backwards. But it is just so exciting. Like, we have taken it one step further and we're saying, hey, go do things. We're giving people prompts. We're giving people space to write. I mean, this book is meant to be written in. It's meant for kids to draw in it. I mean, how cool is that to give a kid a book and say, here you go, write, draw, whatever.
For sure. There's 52 things that we love to do in nature. And so the way it's structured is that some of those kind of the simple things are at the beginning of the book. So like sit out and observe the tiniest of details around you and then record what you see. And if you stop and just look and listen, you're going to notice a lot more than if you just, you know, buzz through your day. All the way to number 52 is climb to the top of a hill or a mountain. And so kind of the symbolic gesture of being at the top and conquering that mountain, you know, it's just kind of a great way to end the book on. But yeah, 52 activities in that thing, and each one has a little writing prompt or a sketch page or...
Yeah, and there's lots of space to kind of keep that journal. The reason this whole book kind of got started is we started talking about baby books and memory books, and you would keep, you know, the first tooth came in on this day, and the favorite, you know, animal was this. And it's like people do that when kids, you know, are one up to two, but then that kind of fades off and you don't have that same kind of notes on your kids anymore. So we said, what can we do about that? And so this is meant to, like, be past the baby book stage, do it with your kids, write down, you know, what's your favorite animal, what's your favorite place to go in nature, and then they can pop this back out whenever they're 16, 18, or whenever they have kids.
This seems like it'd be really neat to go back and revisit when they're grown-ups.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I will say one thing about it, though. It's not going to hang on the fridge very good, just like, you know, some of those other pictures those kids are bringing in.
But it's not unlike – it's probably about the size of a farmer's almanac. You could punch a hole through it and hang it someplace, although I guess they did that for the outhouse in the farmer's almanac days.
Yeah, you absolutely could. I mean, one of the activities in there is go on a picnic. And so, like, how we treat that, like our first book, we just had lots and lots of activities, one activity after the other. And this has fewer activities, but just so much room to say, like, okay, you went on a picnic. What was the weather like on that day? You know, what was the date that we went? What did we take to eat on the picnic? What kind of animals did we see? Where did we go? So,
And it's the kind of thing that actually doesn't have to take them out of the moment. They can be writing about this in the car ride on the way home, or even after they get home, you know, as they're putting off going to bed.
Right, exactly. And so some kids, you know, my kids are 8 and 10, and I can hand this book to them and they can write in it. Journaling is such a big activity in schools these days to kind of get kids to write that you can hand that to older kids and just have them do that. On the flip side, you know, if you have a 2-year-old, a 3-year-old, or even the little kids, it's meant for you to write with them or about them or kind of, you know, prompt them and then get their answer and document it in that way.
It really is a family book. And so you're going to get out there with your, you know, children or with your grandchildren and kind of preserve those moments and help pass on kind of what you did as a kid, too. It'll help kind of jog some of those memories and be like, you know, growing up, this is what I did. Now we're doing it together. So it's kind of fun.
Well, and I noticed also that to take things one step further beyond that, you have some other resources that you link to at the back and maybe even just some blank pages for kids who, you know, either feel constrained by the format or might just want to keep doodling or drawing after they complete the activities.
Yeah. We really hope this inspires, you know, to the kids to get out there and build on it and have their own ideas and kind of harness that creativity. And yeah, I mean, if you're tapped into the local nature scene, there's plenty of activities and stuff. And a lot of those things in that book can happen anywhere. That's the beauty. You know, you step outside and experience nature no matter where you are. But there's also national resources. There's like Get Outdoor Day. There's, you know, Serve September and Go Month in April. There's a lot of things going on. And so there's ways to be involved on both the local and national level with the nature movement.
You mentioned activity number one and activity number 52. Are there any other things from inside this book that jump out at you as your particular favorite?
There's so much. I mean, there's fishing activities and to be able to document that. There's also just going like a kayak or canoe trip. Like that's a great activity for families to do and to really document. You know, we have in there like who liked the canoe trip the most, who liked it the least, you know, because documenting every piece of that experience is really fun for kids.
I think one that I really like in there is predicting the weather. You know, we actually have it set up where there's 5 days worth of kind of meteorology. And you're like, all right, I think it's going to be this weather. And then you can actually record that. And so, I mean, these are little scientists that we're creating. It's kind of a fun to think that, you know, maybe we got some future, you know, weather reporter in the crowd.
Yeah. One of my favorite parts of the book is at the very beginning, we have the kids and the parents actually fill out a section about themselves. So the kid can put their name and they say, you know, what's their favorite animal? Where's their favorite place to go outside? And then on the flip side, the parents have a couple of pages to say, what's special about my nature kid? What people have an influence in our lives? What are some of the things that I did as kids? And so even asking those questions kind of gets that rapport going and has like a new appreciation for both the kid and the parent.
Well, it is a terrific resource. And Stacy and Ken, congratulations. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Mitch.
Stacy Tornio and Ken Keffer are the minds behind the website DestinationNature.net. They are our outdoor adventure contributors and authors of two books, including their latest, We Love Nature, a keepsake journal for families who love to explore the outdoors. You can find out more about it from a link at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. One last break, and then Nick Butler's love for rural Wisconsin is evident in his debut novel. We'll learn about it when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. The appeal of rural western Wisconsin is kind of a well-kept secret, but exports from the region are increasing, and we don't mean dairy products. And if it keeps up, western Wisconsin won't be a secret for much longer. We're talking about the region's impressive artistic output through people like musician Justin Vernon, essayist Michael Perry, and most recently, novelist Nicholas Butler. Butler's debut novel, Shotgun Love Songs, got a glowing review in the New York Times last week and was at the top of the American Booksellers Association's March Indie Next Great Reads list. The book is set in the fictional western Wisconsin town of Little Wing, where lifelong friends Henry, Beth, Lee, Ronnie, and Kip have all reconverged after some have spent time away. It's a novel that, at its heart, explores how friendship changes as we grow up. Nick Butler, welcome to Lake Effect.
It's my pleasure.
Was there a catalyst for the story? Can you remember when the germ of a story first crystallized in your head, to mix a couple of metaphors?
I do, yeah. I was in my first semester at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and it was sort of weird circumstances in my life at that time. My wife and son were living in Minneapolis, and I was also living in Minneapolis, but I would commute down to Iowa City on Mondays and commute back on Wednesdays or Thursdays. And so we didn't have a whole lot of money, so I rented a room from an adjunct professor, and inside the room I just had one half of my brother-in-law's red childhood bunk bed, a white table, and a folding chair. And I was really, really lonely and homesick. And so it wasn't like an idea that was the germ of the first chapter that later became the novel. It was more like this emotional key, this sense of just being like, ugh. You know, I want to get home. I want to be with my family.
Well, and I had this thought that maybe it was the core friendship that was really the central character in this story. But as mm-hmm. you describe it, it's almost as though the place, this idea of home, this small town in Wisconsin, yeah. is the central character in the story.
Well, I think it is a character in a way. I mean, to me, the best literature, the best fiction is place-based. For me, my favorite novel of all times is Sometimes a Great Notion by Ken Kesey. I also like The Shipping News by Annie Proulx. And these are just novels that are deeply rooted in place, and Wisconsin is the place I've spent most of my time. So that's what I wanted to show people.
Well, right. One of the recurring themes in the novel involves the characters thinking about what keeps them in Wisconsin and what yeah. might drive them away. Did you have any reconciling of your own attitude towards the state, or was it unabashed sentimentality towards Wisconsin?
Well, I wouldn't say it was unabashed sentimentality, because I'd like to think that the novel is pretty clear-eyed about both the good and bad of small-town Wisconsin. For example, there's no jobs, or it's hard to get a job. The face of our farmers is changing. It's hard to be a small town farmer or a small dairy operation. So it wasn't like outright sentimentality, but it was a real longing for the place that I had come from and a deep desire to sort of show people how great it is, you know?
Well, and not to tar people on both coasts with the same brush, but I wonder if you thought of people's preconceived ideas about small-town Midwesterners when you wrote this. The rest of the country might not think of Wisconsin or its people as textured as they actually are.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't even expect the novel to be published, right? When you're writing your book, you don't – that's
– You don't write it to be published necessarily.
Well, you're kind of writing it for yourself, hopefully, to keep yourself going. First off, my expectation was not that it would get published. I don't know that many people on either American coast, so that couldn't be a concern for mine. And really, it was more about writing for me, writing for my colleagues at Iowa, writing for my family, and yeah.
You said it started as you were commuting back and forth from Iowa City to Minneapolis. How far along did you get in that set of circumstances?
Well, the first chapter was basically written in one long sitting. First 35 or so pages of the book have never really been extensively edited. That was one sitting, just words kind of just coming in the most pleasurable way that a writer can work. It was fantastic. And I turned that into my colleagues at the Writers' Workshop that first semester with James Allen McPherson, and they were overwhelmingly positive. And it was one of the wonderful ways that workshop can work, where people give you good, positive feedback, tell you what's wrong. However, I have a hard time sort of listening to praise, so I didn't do anything more with it until the spring when I was sort of drawn back to the same town. Not even the same characters. It was going to be a different characters, and it was the idea was to write another novella that would be kind of loosely linked to this first thing. But they really weren't cohesive. So then I did put them together, but then it was over the course of the next 2 years that I sort of evened things out, found who the best characters were, who I was going to follow.
Presumably, as that time went on, you were able to see your wife and your son more. The loneliness didn't drive it quite as much.
Well, I mean, it was the first year it was that same kind of schedule. It was Monday through Thursday I'd be gone. Second year it was Monday through Wednesday, which is a little more hospitable. But it was a rough 2 years.
So you've created this core group of people, and we hear from all of them. You narrate the book from all of their points of view. When you started it, was there any one central character, or did they really all kind of come along at the same time? There's Henry and his wife Beth, there's Lee, there's Ronnie, there's Kip. Was one of them at the heart of the story when it began for you?
I think the heart of the story was always going to be the friendship between Henry and Lee. You know, I don't know why it is, but lately I've been thinking a lot about Paul Newman, watching old Paul Newman films, and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid is one of my all-time favorite films. And so, and I don't know why, but we don't see male friendship or even just friendship represented that way. You know, I really sort of reject this term bromance, which was not around when I was not even around 5 years ago, probably, right? And I feel like it kind of undermines the notion of just having a friend who you love, truly. You know, who's a good friend to you. And so that's kind of what I was, you know, that's what I thought the main thrust was.
Right. I mean, it seems that most of the friendships as they're portrayed in fiction are fairly shallow, if you will, or at least they're not explored as deeply as they might be.
You write the book you want to write, hopefully. And this is the book that I wanted to write. And it did explore. I'm very blessed to have a lot of good friends, like spectacular friends that I know. Right now, if something bad happened to me, they would be there for me. And I also love them, and they've been there at difficult times in my life. And friendship is hard. It's hard to find good friends that are going to be with you your whole life.
There's this tension between all of them in different ways and betrayal that plays out over the course of the pages of this book. And yet in reading it, you create sympathy for all of them. And even the character who we kind of expect to hate early on. Was there a challenge in this for you in making all of your central characters eminently likable?
I'm not sure that I know that they're all eminently likable, but I will say that after I got done writing what would be the first chapter, I did feel like Kip was a villain. And, you know, the thing is, there aren't a lot of just truly horrific people. There are. They're out there. There's monsters. But this was a character who just made a lot of bad decisions, and he represents something in my own life, which I guess you could call regret, where I just think about ways that I have not been as good or decent to people as I could, you know? So Kip sort of starts off one way, but then I'd like to, you know, here's an original literary thought. You know, I'd like to believe in character development, so.
And in referring to, you know, Kip as representing regret in your own life, mm-hmm. without wanting to paint this as an autobiographical yeah. novel, I was curious whether all the various friends in this core group each sort of represent you at a different phase or at a different way in your life, or whether you even thought of them that way.
Yeah, I can say I definitely did not think of them that way. I think there's pieces of me in every character, as there probably is in every novelist's novel. But you also want to shy away from that, because I want people to imagine these characters the way that they imagine them, not components of me. I'm pretty boring.
One of the central characters of the book is an international rock star who is from this little town you've created, Little Wayne, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. There's, of course, actually a pretty well-known rock star from that part of the state. How much did Justin Vernon figure into the creation of Lee?
Yeah, well, I have to say that growing up in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, which is, I would say, a upper middle class town, you know, it's pretty affluent. But there was no template for artistic success. And it's true that I went to high school with Justin, and when he hit it big, everyone is so proud of him and so happy for him. And seeing his success, I think, gave a lot of us like a kind of confidence to move forward, you know, and I'm proud of his success. And I have nothing but fond memories of him in high school, just being a really kind person, and he does so much for our community now. You know, one of the interesting things is, as I was writing this book, I kept thinking, why didn't anybody write this book about Bob Dylan? Like, why hasn't this book been written? Except that Bob Dylan did not come home to Hibbing, whereas Justin Vernon came back to Eau Claire and is actively involved in the community. So, yeah, I just think he's a huge inspiration.
And it is remarkable because everybody, almost to a person mm-hmm. in Little Wing that you've created, yeah. has that attitude towards Lee, that yeah. They are truly happy for his success
yeah.
and kind of honored that he came back.
Well, you know, the thing really is, like, I haven't seen Justin in 15 years, but I do know that he's been working at this thing forever. Everybody from Eau Claire can remember his early bands and how long he's stuck with it. And it's one of those testaments to being an artist, you know, just stick with it.
One of the other threads that shows up that, I don't know, might be overlooked in this book is parenthood. As the book plays out, only Henry and Beth have kids.
Yeah.
But there's a kind of venerated attitude towards parenting that many of the characters have. How do you see your own parenthood, being a parent, shaping how parenting is portrayed in this book?
Well, I really like being a parent. That's a banal answer, but it's true. I do like being a parent. And I think the reason why it's in the book is that, at least for me, I'm at this point in my early 30s where some people can have kids no problem, and other people, for whatever reason, they can't have kids, or maybe they've waited too long. They've done the professional thing so long, and now it doesn't seem natural, or maybe their bodies aren't cooperating. And so it's this real specific problem for a certain age group that I happen to be a part of. And, you know, you just look around at people that you know and think, I don't know, that's worth exploring, I guess, you know?
Well, and it's something, I mean, there are moments that Lee, in watching his friends, Henry and Beth, as they parent, and for all of the other characters looking at Lee and basically treating what he has been able to do with music as amazing and wonderful, he seems to have the same attitude towards Henry and Beth and their ability to take care of their kids.
Yeah, well, I think that's true. And conversely, you know, Henry and Beth are thinking, boy, it would probably be nice to have a night out or, you know, be away from the kids, as they do in New York when they go to visit his wedding. So, you know, I think it's probably a case of grass is always greener.
There's also a scene that is really striking, actually, kind of late in the book. Kip is looking at this kind of odd relationship he had with a farmer couple from Illinois, and this couple has lost a son, and he kind of compares being a parent to being a trader, and essentially, you know, when you have one, putting all your eggs in this one basket. And it was really, you know, the sort of tenuous nature of having this other person that is yours.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think about it sometimes. My wife and I just moved our family to a very rural part of Wisconsin, south of Eau Claire, and we love it. I don't know that my kids will love it. you know, maybe it's just the kind of thing that's going to push my kids as far away from me as possible. You know, why do we live here? You know, I want to go to New York City or Paris or something like that. You just don't know. I mean, you're inviting a new human being, a new spirit into the world, and you don't have any control over what's going to happen.
This book has been a part of you for a long time. As we have this conversation, it is publication date, and yeah, it's already getting positive reviews from other parts of the country. We were having the conversation before we turned on the microphones. This is kind of a surreal moment for you.
It's super surreal. I mean, it's – yeah, I don't know what to say. I mean, it's surreal on so many different levels. I could chew your ear off for 2 hours about why I find it hard to comprehend, beginning with the fact that having gone to school at Iowa with so many talented people, and many of them are publishing books, you know, that are coming out soon or afterwards, but I never thought of myself or my writing as being better than theirs. I mean, I looked around and thought, holy cats, these people are talented. This is the next generation of writers. And so this is surreal. Like, having my book out is weird. And I never made any money my whole life, ever at all. And to finally have a little money and to get paid as an artist is bizarre.
Is it strange that the book goes from being potential to being what it is?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's – every aspect of this whole thing is very bizarre. As I was kind of telling you before, like, the book has been out in Germany for 7-8 months. You just think, how is this thing resonating in Germany? Like, what did they see in it?
Do you get feedback from Germany?
Yeah. They seem to like it. I don't know. That's weird to me.
In a way, it must be like growing up overnight. Like, this is life before, and now, boom, this is where things go from here.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't even know. I don't know where to begin. When you're a writer and you're waiting for your big break, you're waiting for any break, right? You're so happy for any kind of break. And then when you sort of begin to make your own momentum, then the breaks just happen for you. And that is weird. You know?
That much more pressure on the next one, though.
Well, right. Thanks. Thank you for that.
Well, Nick Butler, I wish you all the success in the world. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Nicholas Butler's debut novel is called Shotgun Love Songs. Butler lives outside Eau Claire, an area where the book is set. You can hear him read an excerpt from the novel at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's Tuesday's edition of Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the program, Milwaukee County Board Chairwoman Marina Dmitrievich talks about county cultural attractions and the future of transit. Plus, a documentary looks at some iconic Marquette basketball uniforms, and we will meet a real live 21st century blacksmith. That's tomorrow on the program. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock. Fresh air is next.